This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning with your host, Gordon Deal.
Delay for an Obamacare repeal. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal. Along with Jennifer Koschenka, it is Wednesday, June 28. Welcome aboard. Here's what we have for you this hour.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has postponed a vote on a health insurance overhaul until after the July 4th recess. There simply wasn't enough Republican support.
For the second time in 2 months, a cyber attack in the form of ransomware has hit companies around the globe, especially in Europe.
Three current and former Chicago police officers have been indicted on charges they tried to cover up the fatal shooting of teenager Laquan McDonald.
And the beach towns where homes are actually affordable if you like life on the water.
It's beach time and nobody wants to go back to work, and you think, oh, I could never buy a vacation home in a beach town. They're all super expensive, right? So I poked around for a few days looking for beach towns where the median home costs less than $250,000.
Katie Hill at moneyish.com on affordable beach towns from the Northeast, Southeast, and West Coast. She's here in about 20 minutes. Senate Republican leaders have postponed a vote on a health care insurance bill until after the July 4 recess. The delay was announced yesterday after it became clear that there was not enough Republican support for the measure. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, in a case of coulda, woulda, shoulda, thinks tackling this legislation should not have been the first priority.
It would have been better had the president started with infrastructure, which has bipartisan support, rather than tackling a politically divisive and technically complex issue like health care.
After the vote was postponed yesterday, President Trump summoned all Republican senators to the White House.
We have really no choice but to solve this situation. Obamacare is a total disaster.
From now until Congress's return from the recess, the Wall Street Journal says there is likely to be a run of deal-making, arm-twisting, and lobbying, with voters voicing their opinions in town hall meetings, Republican leaders offering changes, and lobbyists trying to sway senators on all sides. Well, the U.S. is ramping up preparations for a possible military strike against the Syrian regime after Washington said it picked up signs that it was preparing to use chemical weapons again. You'll recall there was a White House warning late Monday that the Syrian regime would pay a, quote, heavy price if it launches another chemical weapons attack. Pentagon spokesman Captain Jeff Davis yesterday said the warning came after officials learned Syria had armed a warplane with chemical weapons.
They have specific places on the base, specific aircraft shelters that are associated with chemical weapons.
Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., told a congressional hearing that the warning was not just for Syria.
The goal is at this point not just to send Assad a message, but to send Russia and Iran a message that if this happens again, we are putting you on notice.
In April, the U.S. launched a cruise missile strike on a Syrian airfield after a chemical attack widely blamed on the Assad regime killed more than 80 people. Well, the U.S. pilot who shot down a Syrian regime attack jet earlier this week, or last week rather, attempted a series of aerial maneuvers to warn the Syrian pilot away from attacking U.S.-backed ground forces, like dropping flares and talking over an open radio frequency. The commander of U.S. Air Force's Central Command says it was only after the Syrian ignored the warnings that the U.S. pilot fired on him. What's this mean going forward? Here's Jim Michaels, military writer at USA Today. Jim, what do we have?
Well, you know, of course, the U.S. Coalition, the intent in Syria and Iraq is to focus exclusively on ISIS, on the Islamic State, and that's what they've been doing for the past several years. Syria in particular, it's always been a very, very complicated environment. You got Russia, you got Iran, you got the United States-led coalition, sometimes with the same objectives, sometimes with different objectives. But this latest concern is this, and that is that Iran has tried to attack U.S. partner forces in southern Syria on several occasions. U.S. aircraft shot down two drones and a Syrian jet. And the two drones in particular seem to be a effort by Iranian-backed forces in sort of southern Syria there to hold on to terrain that they feel they may lose as the Islamic State is being pushed out. In other words, Iran is starting to look at what's going to happen once ISIS has been defeated in Syria, and they don't want to hold, they don't want to lose the influence they have and the ability to move through southern Syria to basically to create a sort of communication line from Tehran, from Iran, all the way to Lebanon.
I didn't realize that last week when the that Navy fighter shot down that Syrian jet, that was the first air-to-air kill by an American plane since 99 during the Kosovo campaign?
Right. It's been a long time. This war now, I mean, the United States has enjoyed air superiority unparalleled, which is why the whole issue of deconflicting, as they call it, with Russia is so important, because that's a what they would call a near peer adversary. But up until now, the U.S. has enjoyed absolute unparalleled air superiority over Syria.
We're speaking with USA Today military writer Jim Michaels. He's written a piece entitled Attacks Heighten Complexity of Air War in Syria. What about, I don't know, maybe following that incident of that air-to-air kill, that the U.S. could get drawn in deeper now?
Well, I think the intent is to let Iran know in particular, because the drones were connected to Iranian-backed forces. The Syrian jet may have been sort of a separate issue, but nonetheless, they were also attacking or about to attack U.S. partner forces. So I think the message that the Pentagon wants to send at this point is if attacked, if interfered with, we will fight back and we'll take aircraft down if necessary. They want that message so that they can continue to focus on ISIS. Now, the question is, has that message been received? So far, it seems to be. But we'll see, because Iran does want to hold on to that terrain. They're looking long-term here. They're not about to just fold up their tent and go back home. They want to influence Syria. They have influenced Syria. And so they're concerned about this. Now, I think they may keep their powder dry for now and not attempt to probe or attack U.S. forces. I do think, or the partner forces on the ground, I do think they've been the sort of immediate message. Long term remains to be seen.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Michaels, military writer at USA Today. Reminder, by the way, that we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter with the username at This Morning Show. If you like some cynicism and sarcasm, you can follow me directly on Twitter with the username at Gordon Deal. 14 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Glad you could spend some time with us on this Wednesday. Well, for the second month in a row now, cyber attacks have wreaked havoc across much of Europe and some of the U.S. A virus whose victims include major global companies like Merck, the pharmaceutical giant, has similarities to last month's global ransomware attack. More from this morning's Mike Gavin.
The attack, which security experts nicknamed Petya, exposed fresh weaknesses in computer systems across Ukraine, Russia, and elsewhere. The virus locked digital files and demanded as much as $300 for them to be returned at more than 100 companies and institutions. Many victims were told to pay the ransom in the digital currency Bitcoin. Others saw political motivations behind the attack, which struck the day before Constitution Day, a Ukrainian national holiday. Gordon.
Thanks, Mike. The ransomware, by the way, was designed to spread within corporate networks running the Windows operating system, but security experts told the Wall Street Journal that it didn't appear to be harming consumers. A Microsoft spokeswoman said the company was investigating. 20 minutes after the hour on this morning, Jennifer Koschenka is here with more of America's First News.
Gordon, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says good progress was made during a White House meeting between President Trump and Republican senators. Trump invited them to meet after McConnell decided to delay a vote on a Senate health care bill because there aren't enough votes to pass it. McConnell says the vote will be held after the July 4th recess.
I had hoped, as you know, that we could have gotten to the floor this week, but we're not quite there. But I think we've got a really good chance of getting there. It'll just take us a little bit longer.
McConnell says negotiating with Senate Democrats won't produce any of the changes sought by Republicans, including to the health markets and Medicaid. Three former or current Chicago police officers have been charged with allegedly conspiring to cover up the fatal police shooting of a black teen. Special Prosecutor Patricia Brown says the three face charges of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and official misconduct.
They failed to interview specific witnesses, that they lied or provided false or misleading or mischaracterized information on official forms.
Laquan McDonald was shot 16 times by a white officer in 2014, sparking widespread protests across the city. Officer Jason Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder in 2015 after dash cam footage appeared to show him fatally shooting McDonald as he moved away from officers, contradicting police accounts. The National Safety Council says no state goes far enough to protect residents from preventable death and injuries. None of the 50 states received an A rating when it comes to road, home, and community and workplace safety. Seven states received a B for safety measures, while 11 states received an F rating. The National Safety Council says 140,000 people die each year because of events that could have been prevented. Where do the ultra-rich live? Still, New York City. The metro area remains the top magnet for the rich, attracting more than 8,300 residents with a net worth of at least $30 million in 2016. WealthX says Hong Kong and Tokyo remain the second and third most popular global cities for the ultra-rich. London and Paris rank fifth and sixth.
Man.
$30 million.
At least $30
million. Yeah, okay.
That's good living right there. That doesn't take into account the 10 millionaire. Group, right?
No, this is
or the five millionaire
group.
No,
this is the ultra.
This is the ultra. Thank you, Jen. 23 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us. Welcome into Wednesday. Sand and surf does not have to cost seven figures. While real estate in celebrity towns like Malibu and the Hamptons averages more than $1 million, there are plenty of charming beach towns you can actually afford. Handful of cities across the country where the median home costs less than $250,000 from Katie Hill, editor at Moneyish.com. Katie, what have you found?
Well, I think for us, it's beach time and nobody wants to go back to work. And you think, oh, I could never buy a vacation home in a beach town. They're all super expensive, right? So I poked around for a few days looking for beach towns where the median home costs less than $250,000. So reasonably affordable for a lot of Americans. Here's what I found. Number one, Gulfport, Mississippi. Homes there are actually under $200,000, and it's really having quite a resurgence. I just saw Vogue just wrote an article about it and saying, they said, quote, this city is having a serious comeback moment. And it really is. It's the coastline is beautiful.
Yeah.
The beaches are nice. There's a little bit of an art scene there. So it's really, you know, post-Katrina having a comeback, but still the prices are completely reasonable, $171,000 for the average home.
I've been salivating lately over these stories when you start poking around. You get the private island story you did.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Now we're talking about...
Can you tell when I want to go on vacation really badly? A story goes on the site of how do you do this on a budget.
Very good. All right, so closer to you and I in the Northeast, Keensburg, New Jersey.
Yeah, Keensburg. So most of these coastal towns that are within an hour or two of Manhattan are way, way more expensive. Keensburg, not so much, $100,000 roughly for a house. Again, these are not on the ocean houses, but you could walk or bike there. You know, it's got a little amusement park that has a bunch of water slides. There's a little beach boardwalk, and I mean, the big perk for someone who lives in New York City is that this is close. You can easily drive from the city into Keensburg and hit the beach.
We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at Moneyish.com. She's written a piece called Six Gorgeous Beach Towns Where You Can Actually Afford to Buy a Home. Here's one I had not heard of: Port Angeles, Washington.
Yeah, a couple towns I found in Washington and Oregon that had nice little beach towns. Port Angeles is beautiful, and it's not a Florida beach, obviously. So it's not necessarily what people often think of when they think of the beach, but it is on the water. And houses are about 220,000. It's just a short drive from Olympic National Park, which is just this gorgeous, huge, super green, with mountains and rainforests and all of that. So a really good beach town for someone who's super outdoorsy as well. So yeah, that's why that ended up on the list.
Thanks, Katie. That is Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday, June 28. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Some of our top stories and headlines: the Senate delays a vote on health insurance. Cyber attacks hit companies across the world. Sarah Palin suing the New York Times for defamation. BBC investigation finds iced coffee at Starbucks in the UK contains levels of fecal bacteria. 56 new emojis on the way, including the finger to the lips whisper emoji. And perhaps the most important one, a Chinese food takeout container with chopsticks. And the waitress who saved a choking girl. That story in about 20 minutes. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is traveling to areas of her state that were friendly to Donald Trump during the election, hoping to connect with his backers and provide a roadmap for her party to win back working class voters. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein. Reed, what have you seen?
Well, Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, is doing a series of town hall events in parts of Massachusetts where the president did particularly well. I went up last week to see her do a town hall in Lowell, which is sort of a gritty, down-on-its-luck place near the New Hampshire border. If you remember the movie The Fighter, it was set in Lowell. Trump had one of his big arena rallies at the hockey arena there. And Warren sort of tells a similar story as Trump. She has a very similar diagnosis to the nation's problems, that the nation is not as strong as it used to be, and things have been going downhill for a while. Of course, her prescription for what she would do to fix it is diametrically opposed to what both Trump campaigned on and how he's governed. But her effort to reach out to voters for whom the economy has not been done well, and people who think that remember when times were better, is not that different from what Trump did during his campaign.
Is she trying to win back Trump voters, or sort of the Trump voters who were anti-Hillary? What's she after here?
Well, and to be fair, there's not a lot of Trump people that are coming to her events, but she's going to parts of Massachusetts, her state, that are down on their luck or not as prosperous as, you know, as areas where more Democrats happen to live. And what she's trying to do is road test a little bit of a message that to try to see what it will take to win more votes out of those areas than Democrats have. Senator Warren is up for re-election next year, next November in 2018. It's Massachusetts. She's not expected to have a terribly competitive challenge, but we can expect to see some of these themes and messages that she is discussing now will certainly have a place in the next Democratic presidential primary, whether she's a candidate or not.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein. He's written a piece entitled "Elizabeth Warren Tries to Win Back Voters in Trump Country." You said, too, she feels there's broad support for raising the minimum wage, expanding Social Security,
and forgiving student loan debt. I mean, wow. I mean, what price tag for that stuff?
Well, but she is right. If you ask, if you poll any of those questions sort of individually, they do poll very well. Minimum wage, increasing the minimum wage is always, if you ask people in a yes or no question, it does very well in polling, in the same way that a lot of gun control proposals do very well in polling. The problem with for people who support those things is, once interest groups start to advertise against them and politicians vote on them, they tend not to win votes, because even though people might support those issues, they don't necessarily vote on them. On their own, in the way that they might other issues that draw more people to the polls.
Thanks, Reed. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us. Beyond the headlines now, this morning's Mike Gavin is here with a look at some of the other stories you'll be talking about this morning.
Good morning. Well, anyone who's ever been in trouble with the law, no matter how minor, has secretly wished that they had a get-out-of-jail-free card, like the one you find in Monopoly, that we could maybe hand over to authorities. But few of us would have the guts to do it, like one man in Minnesota recently did. The Dakota County Sheriff's Office shared a photo earlier this week of the get-out-of-jail-free card a suspect handed a deputy as he was preparing to arrest the suspect for an outstanding warrant during a traffic stop. As you might expect, though, the Hasbro company has little pull over real-life law enforcement, and the man was not able to avoid being arrested for the controlled substance warrant. That didn't stop the department from posting a photo of the card, however, with the caption, "We appreciate the humor," adding that they give the suspect an A for effort.
Yeah. Who carries around cards from board games on their person, by the
way?
Well,
there was a warrant out for his arrest.
Yeah.
So, perhaps he was just anticipating that one day, it's going to come. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when.
All right.
And when it happens, maybe, just maybe, I'll give the officers such a laugh that they'll let me go on my merry way.
Yeah, with a minor traffic violation, not that you're going to jail for that, but that could be humorous and could work in your favor.
Right.
Not for a warrant.
Right.
Definitely not for a warrant.
Maybe they let you off with a warning if it was, like you said, you went through a stop sign or something like that.
Right.
But not for a warrant for a controlled substance.
Where do you keep that anyway? Is that like right next to your driver's license, or it actually with the registration and insurance card in your in your car?
Right. He's got that in the little thing for the insurance card. Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Maybe he could have brought some of the Monopoly hotel pieces and just offered the officer a piece of the action.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, next time you play, here's a hotel. Hope you cash in. brother.
Yes, then he gets in trouble for bribery, I guess, at that point. And, Gordon, a South Carolina couple is looking for some bigger baby clothes today after their son was born at a whopping 14.4 pounds. Cindy Richmond and Arthur Kiesler had a hunch their third child would be a bit bigger than their previous two. The couple's first baby weighed 7.6 pounds, and the second weighed 9.8 pounds. So they just saw it sort of naturally that their third child would maybe top 10 pounds.
Yeah.
But they never expected the number on the scale would be record-breaking.
Right. Well, nearly a 50% increase, by the way, from the second to the third child.
Just a smidge bigger. On Friday, the mom from Lexington, South Carolina, gave birth to baby boy Colin, who was the biggest baby clinicians recall being born ever at Lexington Medical Center since it opened in 1971. In fact, when the attending doctor first showed the parents their newborn delivered via C-section a week before his due date, they both let out an audible gasp.
My God, man, what has happened here?
Yes. Nurses in the delivery room also marveled at the baby, who measured 24 inches long,
Jeepers.
About the size of a typical 4 to 5 month old. The baby's happy and healthy, but there is one problem. His clothes don't fit. The good news is Colin's off to a good start. If he's destined to attain some of his father's early goals for him, perhaps defensive lineman at Clemson University, and then on to play for the Green Bay Packers.
Jeez. It was so big. I mean, did it come out talking already?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just surprised that everybody was so surprised, because normally they do the ultrasounds, right? They have a pretty good idea of what the baby's going to come out like these days. There are very few surprises when it comes to baby births these days. So I'm surprised that everybody was so surprised that he was that big.
Why would they let this go? They had to have known Because later in your pregnancy, right, I mean, you get checked fairly often.
Yeah. I mean,
how did they not detect that this thing was so big? This child was so big.
This beautiful baby boy.
How do you do that to the mother?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, again, it was a week early. I mean, I guess it's only so early that you can do it, right? We know, and still have a healthy baby.
A week early?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we had a situation like that, too, where it looked like my son was, I don't know if he was going to be 14 pounds, but it looked like he was getting up there. So, yeah, he was born, I think, probably 2 weeks early. I think they did the C-section because they were a little worried. Yeah, and he topped out at around 9 pounds and change, but nowhere near 14 pounds.
Goodness. I mean, he's almost like a what would that be, like a featherweight? I mean, by the time he came out, he's ready for wrestling or boxing, given that weight.
Sign him up.
Jeez. 13 minutes now in front of the hour. A new ransomware named Petya hit high-profile targets in multiple countries, including the United States, as we've been reporting today. USA Today has a look at how to protect your business from attacks like Petya. Number one, download patches like WannaCry, which hit last month. Petya is targeting a vulnerability in older Windows systems called Eternal Blue. If you enable Microsoft to automatically update your computer, you should have the patch. For older versions of Windows that Microsoft does not generally support, you can go to the Microsoft website and download the patches you need. Number two, back up your computer with an external hard drive or in the cloud. Number three, install protection programs. These include firewalls, antivirus programs, and other protective software. Number three, don't click on anything suspicious. Some of these attacks occur because of phishing emails. And number four, protect yourself when using public Wi-Fi. Change your security settings on your computer when on a public network. It's 8 minutes now in front of the hour. On this morning, Jennifer Koschenka is back with more of America's First News.
Court and Senate Republican leaders are delaying a vote on their health care bill until after the July 4th recess, forced to retreat by a GOP rebellion that left them lacking enough votes to even begin debating the legislation. One of the senators who rebelled was Susan Collins of Maine, who says there is no need for the administration to try to rush this through.
It would have been better had the president started with infrastructure, which has bipartisan support, rather than tackling a politically divisive and technically complex issue like health care.
The health care bill has been one of Republicans' top priorities for years, and the impacts could turn into a political headache for McConnell and President Trump. The Trump administration expects to launch a limited version of its travel ban on six mostly Muslim countries tomorrow, but has yet to say how it will be implemented or what it will do to avoid the chaos that accompanied the initial ban. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert says her department needs more guidance from the Justice Department on who's still allowed in.
Bona fide relationship, we don't have a definition here at the State Department for that yet. None of the agencies has that definition just yet. That we will be working to get. That I anticipate will take a couple days to get that.
The Supreme Court on Monday partially reinstated the ban ahead of hearing arguments in October. A major global cyber attack disrupted computers at Russia's biggest oil company, Ukrainian banks, and multinational firms with a virus similar to the ransomware that infected more than 300,000 computers last month. The rapidly spreading attack, which began yesterday, underscores growing concerns that businesses have failed to secure their networks from increasingly aggressive hackers. More work, less sleep. The Labor Department has released its American Time Use Survey and finds that on average, we spent 4 hours, 36 minutes a day working in 2016 on weekdays, up about 8 minutes from 2015, and a possible result of steady job recovery. The number includes those who work and those who don't, including a growing aging population steadily leaving the labor force. Meanwhile, the average amount of time we spent sleeping on weekdays ticked down 5 minutes to an average of 8 hours and 30 minutes a day.
Who gets 8 hours and 30 minutes a day?
We have to, this figures kids in as well.
Oh, okay.
So if you take all the population, okay. But most people, I know, we do these stories all the time that nobody gets enough sleep. Nobody gets 8 hours of sleep.
That's roughly 2 to 3 nights worth of sleep for me.
I know.
Eight
but,
and a half,
well,
right?
Let's put babies in there.
Same for you. Okay.
If they sleep like 20 hours, then that skews everything.
Wrecking the curve so the rest of us can't get help. Thanks, Jen. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. Thanks for being with us. A quick-thinking waitress saved the life of a 9-year-old girl in northern New Jersey who was choking. The waitress heard the girl's screams and rushed to help. CBS News says little Kai Rogers says she and her family ate chicken fingers at the Chili's restaurant in the town of Paramus recently. All of a sudden, the girl started to choke. The girl's mother, Tara Harvey, was next to her. She knew how to do the Heimlich maneuver, but she panicked. That was when waitress Dina Gonzalez stepped in.
As she heard all the commotion from the other side of the restaurant, she came running over. Girl was still choking. Ms. Gonzalez performed the Heimlich. After three pumps, food came out. She says it was all instinct. Her uncle, who's a firefighter, taught her the maneuver. She says in her 11 years at that Chili's restaurant, her first time using the Heimlich. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News. Hey, thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more from This Morning Show, check us out at thismorningwithgordondeal.com.